everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and also a great big speculative fiction nerd. Now, for every episode of this show, Catherine and I are going to take turns picking out a movie or a television show to analyze, and this week was my pick. So I decided to cheat just a little bit, and I picked two episodes of Star Trek, one from the original series, one from Deep Space Nine. They did have a crossover episode. So from the original series, we have The Trouble with Tribbles, classic fan favorite, and then from Deep Space Nine, we have Trials and Tribulations. And these two are really related in an interesting way, I think. Just let me start out. I'll give you the summary, and then perhaps Catherine and I will get into sort of our own experience with Trek, because this is our first episode of a big franchise, other than The X-Files, of course. Don't want to put down The X-Files here. But, you know, it's just been something that's been really, really significant. So here's the summary. So for those of you who have not seen this one, in this episode, the Enterprise receives a distress signal from a space station. They rush in and discover there's no emergency. Only a minor bureaucrat who wants his storage compartments full of grain for a colony planet protected. Then the Klingons arrive, just to spice things up a little bit.
How close will we come to the nearest Klingon outpost if we continue on our present course?
1 parsec, sir. Close enough to smell them.
That is illogical, Ensign. Odors cannot travel through the vacuum of space.
With those tensions high, a species of small animals called tribbles, they come onto the scene, they reproduce prodigiously, and they begin to take over the station and the Enterprise to much great comedic effect. However, eventually, they end up eating all of the grain in the storage compartments and end up dying from it. They're poisoned. And that helps Kirk to uncover a Klingon agent and a plot to poison the grain. So in the Deep Space Nine episode, what happens is that the same disgraced agent conspires to take the Defiant and its crew back in time for a do-over. And here, hilarity ensues as the Deep Space Nine characters are composited into scenes from the original series episode. So that's what we've got looking at this week. So why don't I start with you, Catherine, and you know, what's your relationship to Trek?
I'm a big Star Trek fan. My origin with the show comes from Star Trek The Next Generation, which aired from 1987 to 1994. So that was on when I was really young, probably my first introduction to science fiction. So my memory of it is a bit spotty as a child, since it started when I was 6 years old. But I do vividly remember watching the series finale with my family, and it really holds a special place for nostalgia with me. I did eventually watch Deep Space Nine and Voyager when I was an adult, but they have less nostalgia for me because I wasn't watching them in real time. But it has been fun now that I have my own kids to watch the more recent Star Trek series like Lower Decks and Strange New Worlds with my daughter and introduce her to the Star Trek world. And so that's been a lot of fun.
For me, it was a little bit similar. I think, you know, since you and I are the same age, that The Next Generation, that was what was on when we were fairly young. I feel like Deep Space Nine is a little bit more my series. I've always sort of identified with that particular one, a little bit darker, a little bit longer plots. All the things that Star Trek fans hated about it in the 90s, I just loved. And the other one that I ended up spending a lot of time with was actually the original series. And this was because my parents, my father especially, he was a huge Star Trek fan. And it used to come on Saturday afternoons on CBC all throughout my childhood. So I got a random collection of different episodes of the original series that was just sort of, you know, fun to see. So for me, I think it had a big effect, right? And you often hear of the effect of Star Trek trying to motivate people to go into science, technology, engineering, mathematics, even the arts. And I remember had astronauts that did cameos on Star Trek at one point on The Next Generation, I believe it was. So there was this interesting interplay, I think, of art and science there. And just the idea, I think, of an optimistic future was appealing as a kid, certainly. I don't know. Did you feel that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And I think that's the primary reason I really enjoyed Star Trek was its optimism. Other people our age also really enjoy Star Wars, but I could never get into that because it was such a pessimistic view of the future. And that's not the future I wanted to envision. I wanted the hopeful, whimsical future that was presented in Star Trek. And so, you know, I've never been a big Star Wars fan. I wanted that hopeful future that they presented. I never did really watch the original series. Now, you know, watching The Trouble with the Tribbles for this podcast was maybe the only full episode I've ever seen. And it was honestly, it was better than I was expecting for a, you know, 60-year-old television show at this point. I could see why people really enjoyed it. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Oh, I was just going to say, what can I tell you? They're all this good. No, I'd be lying. This is definitely one of the
better ones.
Mm-hmm, yeah, but there's something to enjoy, I think, in most of what they're offering. Just a really fascinating thing to see. And one thing, I know we're going to get into this now in a minute. One thing I really like about this pair of episodes is just the way that they play with a lot of the concepts that we've been exploring, you know, in putting this podcast together. And you get to see that difference between the 1960s and the hopeful optimism there, and, you know, still hopeful optimism in the 90s, but the flavor is a little different. Well, why don't we just go ahead and we'll start with our favorite part, which is always the science gripes. You know, what did they get wrong? And I feel like Star Trek never really prided itself on being a super accurate representation of the future. So we've got a few here, and we're not just going to cover ones that are in this episode. I think we're going to talk about things that affect the entire Trek universe here.
Yeah, I went a little off script here because there's just some things that bother me about Star Trek in general. It's almost hard to say it's science fiction. It's almost more like science fantasy because there's so many, I would call them magical plot devices that they use in Star Trek that really have no basis in any actual science. I started making a list and just kept going. Things like gravity. They never explain how these ships have gravity. For Ender's Game, our previous episode, you know, they at least tried to show that the ship was spinning and so you could generate artificial gravity that way. I'm not sure what explanation they're trying to go for here on Star Trek, but they never discuss it at any length.
Yeah, I feel like the best you can do with this stuff is just, you know, to quote Arthur C. Clarke's maxim about how any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic a little bit. You know, there's something in the floor plates that keeps you down. There's the mysterious inertial dampers that keep you from becoming raspberry jelly on the walls. Hey, we're so good with gravity and this sort of Newtonian physics that we can even warp space. And that's how we get around the vast distances between all of these different solar systems and planets.
Yeah, like faster than light travel. They never explain that either. You know, they're just gallivanting around the galaxy over these, you know, hundreds, thousands of light years distances that just are scientifically implausible. And even with these inertial dampeners, like every episode, they're getting shaken around. They really need seatbelts, right? I'm surprised nobody has installed a seatbelt on the Enterprise, given how much they get shaken around in these episodes.
It's true. It seems like all of the injuries that are needed by the plot are from some console exploding or from someone getting tossed out of their seat and over a banister and whatnot. You'd think you could have better industrial design, you know, for a ship that's going to get into some trouble like this.
Indeed, indeed. And so my list kept going of the magical plot devices. They use transporters in both the original series and the Deep Space Nine episode. This is a key plot point in many Star Trek series. And that just seems ridiculous that you could take somebody apart atom by atom and then put them back together in another place without killing them. I do like that. So I'm starting to watch Star Trek Enterprise, which is temporally one of the earlier Star Trek series. So they've just sort of invented warp travel. And people seem really nervous about this transporter. And even into Next Generation, there are characters who do not want to use the transporter. And I would get that, right? I don't know how this would work. It seems ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Leonard McCoy, the doctor in the first one, was famous for not wishing to use the transporter. And when you think about it, I remember reading a book when I was a kid called The Metaphysics of Star Trek that wanted to get into all of this sort of, you know, what's the real science here? And I believe it's Lawrence Krauss is the author of that one. And what he mentioned when he gets to the transporter is that, well, there are two different ways of doing this. You can actually disassemble a person atom by atom and then take those atoms and send them somewhere and then reassemble the person. Or you can simply go ahead and scan the person, get a complete state of that person, kill them, and then send the data elsewhere to be reconstructed. So the person who appears on that other pad is indistinguishable. They feel like they've been transported. They have all the memories. They're exactly the same. But they're not the same person that they were originally. So, you know, that's always kind of stuck with me, the idea that maybe the transporter, you know, kills the characters every time they use it.
And then you could have a transporter clone, right? I mean, you don't just need to clone one person. And they do this in a couple of episodes and then never mention this person, this transporter clone again, which is hilarious. Like if I had a magical twin that just appeared, like I'd probably want to talk to that person and not just ignore them for the rest of my life. But yeah, I mean, Star Trek is famous for its technobabble. It's known that some of the science was considered so nonsensical that they would just write tech in the script and then figure out the words later. And when you listen to them talk, it really doesn't make much sense from a scientific point of view. When we started this podcast, I thought we would, you know, have more Star Trek episodes to discuss, but I'm coming to realize that a lot of them just rely on these sort of magical plot devices that don't have any basis in science.
It's true, but people try to make sense out of them. It's fascinating. Like you, I think we'll talk about stardates a little bit later on, but I'm also just thinking about the warp factors, for instance. Like in The Next Generation, they have a very clear thing, you know, warp 10 is like infinite speed and whatnot. You can only get like closer and closer and closer to that. Whereas in the original series, you know, they're just pulling numbers out of the air. And even within the show, there's this lack of consistency. As long as it sounds sciencey and it sounds technical and it's quantified in some way, you know, it's like we don't even need to know what it means.
I've always wondered watching the show why they don't just always go at warp 9, if that's the limit, right? Why do they go at warp 2 or warp 5? Like, wouldn't you just try to get everywhere as fast as possible? I don't know if they try to explain this.
So it's fascinating. I feel like there's been so many Star Trek episodes now that there is one episode on everything. And I do remember that there was one, I think it's the Next Generation episode, where they were talking about how using high warp factors was actually damaging the galaxy in some ways. And so at the end, they have this very somber moment where they say Starfleet Command has said that, you know, except in dire emergencies, we're now limited to, I think it was like warp 5 or warp 6 or something like that. And everyone's like, goodness, how are we going to continue with this? And that's the end of the episode. And then they never mention it again. And they're just doing
They do. Oh. Actually, I just rewatched that season of TNG, and they break that rule constantly after that episode. They're like, oh, this is really important, so we've authorized you to go beyond warp 5. So it was just this strange thing they had done to make some environmental analogy. I think the episode was pretty bad, and then it just kind of hindered them in all previous or all subsequent episodes. And then they just, I think, forgot about it in the movies and subsequent series.
You know, I wonder if the Next Generation, I mean, okay, we don't have a Next Generation episode here, but I think we've already gone down the whirlpool of talking about All Trek a little bit. I wonder if some of the ideas for these episodes that they did came from things that the fans were annoyed about or pointing out, because there's another one that I'm a fan of, which also seemed to be like, you know, oh, one of these big monumental episodes that then we don't hear much about it again, this idea of preservers. And the name of this episode is The Chase. And in that episode, they actually give a reason why all of the different aliens that you wind up with are basically human beings with skin conditions and not anything more, you know, weird and wonderful.
Yeah, I've recently watched that episode too. So it doesn't make sense that a Klingon would look as much like a human as it does, or a Romulan, or a Cardassian, or whoever else, you know, whatever alien of the week it is. You'd have to be so close together in the Tree of Life. And indeed, we see these species interbreeding. You know, Spock is a human-Vulcan hybrid, and he's not the only one. This is a very common thing throughout the show. So clearly these aliens are all closely related to one another, that they can interbreed, that they look almost identical. Their genetic differences must be tiny. But this episode of TNG, The Chase, tries to explain it all by, you know, some seeding event that an alien did billions of years ago. And so, yes, it would have all the same genetic information on all these different planets, but they wouldn't evolve the same way. We'd have the same starting point, but evolution is a stochastic process. And so you'd end up with different organisms at the end of all that evolution. And so even them trying to explain why all these aliens look the same doesn't actually fly. They'd have to be much more closely related.
Yeah, the speciation can happen quite quickly. But speaking about one of the more Well, I mean, certainly there are a lot of bizarre aliens, especially the ones that live in vacuum, but we'll get to that another time. We've got the Tribbles in this one, which are very fascinating little creatures, just basically little balls of fur. And oh my goodness, they seem to be missing a lot of the machinery and a lot of the things you'd expect from life. They make a noise. Allegedly they eat, although we don't know how they eat because we never see, you know, any orifices in these things. We don't know how they sense things. They're kind of a bizarre, you know, species, aren't they?
Yeah, I heard they were based on a keychain, basically a little fuzzy keychain ring that you would have. and that's, I think, as far as they went down this path. Because, yeah, they didn't give them a mouth. They didn't give them ears, eyes. They just look like little puffballs. And so as much as they appear to eat and reproduce, we don't see them do any of that. They just look like little fuzzy stuffed animals that kind of bounce around the space station.
They stick them to everything, too, like the walls, the floors.
That's right. They're sticky. Don't know why they're sticky, because they look furry, right?
Exactly.
And their reproduction rate seems a little bit unbelievable, too. They say they reproduce every 10 hours, having a litter of triplets. I just made that up. I have no idea what a baby tribble is, every 12 hours. But I don't know how that would work, because you'd have to eat enough food to then generate 10 little tribbles, right? Could you do that in 12 hours? It's not clear. They look mammalian because they have fur. But the fastest breeding mammals are rodents, and they reproduce as short as 16 days. So it's pretty fast, but it's not 12 hours. I mean, that's quite a different order of magnitude there. So they don't really explain how the tribbles can reproduce this quickly.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. It's another one of these things that the episode is based on, that, you know, they need to reproduce this quickly to get to enormous numbers of these creatures. But like you say, there's kind of a conservation of mass type of problem there. Like, can you actually take in that much food, metabolize it into useful, you know, components of your body or child, and then, you know, get them going? Because McCoy says they're born pregnant. So, you know, you've almost got this Matryoshka doll kind of structure to the tribbles, apparently.
I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a good analogy. Yeah, I was really surprised when Bones said that. And so I looked it up, and there are actually species on Earth that are, quote marks, born pregnant. Aphids is one good example of that. They can reproduce asexually, as these tribbles appear to be doing. And when a new female is hatched, she already has eggs growing in her. But like I said, the tribbles look like mammals. They're furry. They don't look like aphids. And so we don't know of any mammals that reproduce this way. All mammalian reproduction is through sexual reproduction. But even if some mammal did invent this way of reproduction, you'd get a much less genetically diverse population, which is not great for going forward as a species. You'd want a more diverse population. And the tribbles do look diverse. They're all different sizes and colors, which, again, isn't super realistic given the way they say that they reproduce.
Yeah, there's a bit of a challenge there. I mean, you can have some, you know, when you get into parthenogenesis, you can have some fun with dominant and recessive traits, depending on exactly how that organism assembles its genes. But I think you're right. We're not headed for good things if it's just simply this asexual reproduction all the way down the line.
Right. So they might reproduce really quickly, but then at some point, even if there wasn't poison grain, they probably all would have started dying off due to the lack of genetic diversity. Although it is true that aphids can switch to sexual reproduction if needed, if times are tough, to increase that genetic diversity.
To your knowledge, does anything reproduce purely asexually and has no way of trading genetic material with other organisms? Because I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Ooh, I don't know. That is beyond my knowledge of biology, unfortunately. There are some crazy things that can happen with single cellular organisms, but that is not what we're talking about with tribbles. They're clearly multicellular organisms.
I do enjoy how we've had a bit of a biological component, I think, in every one of these episodes so far. Unintentionally, of course, but it's kind of neat. You get these different flavors, I think, of science fiction. And some are very, you know, techno-futurist, and it's the tech and the equipment. But there's always this sort of, you know, biological strain of things, which is fun, that runs through a lot of work.
Yeah, and I hope we don't get a lot of angry emails from our biologist colleagues telling us how wrong we are. My knowledge of biology is, I think, goes back to grade 11 biology. Although I do teach a class in astrobiology, so I've had to learn a little bit, but I'm by no means a biologist.
Yeah, that I make two there. And actually, because I did my high school on the East Coast, you didn't actually need to take biology at all. And I didn't. Maybe I shouldn't be admitting this on the air, but...
I didn't either until I got to college. I took grade 10 biology, which I had to, and then I took grade 11 biology as a senior undergraduate student because I knew it would probably be important to learn a little bit more about this subject if I was going to go into the field of astrobiology.
I think that's a good choice. Well, perhaps what we'll do at this point is we'll take just a short break and then we'll come back with the science shine. There were actually things that we liked about this. It's not all just, you know, fun with something futuristic. So we'll be right back. So I think there's a few things about these two episodes which really did impress us. There are places where maybe they didn't have to get it right, but they made an effort to get it right. And one of the things I appreciate is, you know, Spock, he's always computing numbers and probabilities. This is a whole thing during the original series that he's almost a bit of a, I was going to say human computer, but he's a Vulcan or half Vulcan. And so, you know, he has this model that he makes up about, you know, how quickly the tribbles are reproducing and how many of them there are. And, you know, he spouts off numbers, but they're all right, aren't they?
They are. I was pretty shocked. I wrote it all down. So he says, starting with one tribble, has a litter of 10 tribbles every 12 hours. After 3 days, you'd have 1,771,561 tribbles. And I'm like, they just made that number up. But then I went and I did the math, and that's exactly the right number, which is kind of shocking that you could go from one tribble to almost 2 million tribbles over the span of 3 days. It's the definition of exponential growth. As we mentioned earlier, maybe this isn't very realistic that you would have 10 tribbles every 12 hours, but if you could magically do that, then this is the number of tribbles that you would have.
An astounding mass of tribbles, isn't it? And what they were eating, they're actually eating a real grain too.
That was the other thing that surprised me. So they talk about Quadro Triticale as the grain that they're trying to protect on the space station that the tribbles eventually end up eating. And I was like, oh, that's a made up name for sure. But then it turns out it's not. Triticale is an actual grain. It's a hybrid of wheat and rye. It was first developed by scientists in Scotland and Germany in the late 19th century, early 20th century, although it didn't really come into large usage, I think, until about the 60s when this episode first aired. They had some trouble getting a fertile strain of this grain, so it was hard to produce much of it. But now it's a very common hybrid grain. It has the hardiness of rye, but the yields of wheat, so it's a really good cereal grain to grow. I also, my ears perked up when Spock said that it traced back to 20th century Canada, because I actually grew up living on agricultural research farms. My father worked for Agriculture Canada. And so I asked him, you know, did he know what triticale was? Did they research this? And it turns out they did. So there has been quite a bit of research on this grain within Canada. But Spock was wrong that it didn't actually originate in Canada. Like I said, it goes back to some scientists in Scotland and Germany. But certainly Canadians did have a role in developing this hybrid grain.
So there you go. You've got a family connection to this particular episode of Star Trek.
Which I was not expecting. to be clear, Quadro Triticale is not a real grain. It's some future grain they have invented for this show. But Triticale is a real hybrid.
Yeah, I do enjoy how sometimes, just to make something seem more futuristic, they amp up the number of something. So it's not triticale, it's quadro triticale. And there's another one that I remember. I think it was The Fifth Element, actually, which was a movie when we were younger. And they have this perfect being that they're creating, allegedly perfect being. And they compare the DNA of a regular human with her DNA, and it's just more strands around. So it's like a whole tube. And it's like, okay, we just added more, and now it's futuristic and such.
Yeah. Although I was looking up some information about triticale, and I guess there is an ale named Quadro Triticale that they made with the grain. So that's fun. If you want to drink some Quadro Triticale, you can do that.
Well, there you go. Another thing I think they did quite well is thinking about the kind of environment that the tribbles would have come from. They replicate so fast. They eat everything around. They love Quadro Triticale. But they probably have these properties because they're living in an environment with a lot of predators. And so this is an evolutionary strategy to propagate the tribbles, because most of them are just going to get eaten up. And it sounds like that's a great planet if you're a predator. Lots of tribbles being created very quickly. When you take those predators away and you take them to a closed environment, like a space station or a starship, bad things happen without that check on the population. And my mind immediately goes to Australia. I think you were thinking a little bit about Yellowstone there.
Yeah, so apparently this episode was based on the rabbit problem in Australia, where they introduced rabbits and they didn't have much of a predator. And so there's just too many rabbits in Australia. But my mind went to the wolves in Yellowstone. There was an article I'd read on this a couple years ago, because they'd been killed out in the 1920s, and the environment at Yellowstone changed quite dramatically in ways people weren't expecting. You know, people thought, oh, wolves are dangerous, we should get rid of them, and they were hunted to extinction. But what happened, this unintended consequence, is that the elk population exploded. So the wolves were not there to cull the elk herd, and so there were too many elk, just like there's too many tribbles in this episode. And so they started to eat plants. That affected other creatures, like beavers, who needed those trees for their habitats. And since the beavers couldn't, you know, interact with the trees in the way they were used to, suddenly the hydrology of the region was changed because their dams were different. And so it's just amazing how, you know, taking one key species out of environment can really have a ton of unintended consequences. And so this became quite plain within Yellowstone. And so in 1995, they started to reintroduce the wolves. So they've now been there for 30 years, and the whole environment is changing back, perhaps to a state that is more sustainable by just introducing a handful of wolves.
It's a fascinating thing, right? Because I think people like to talk about the question of which is the natural environment. Is it the original environment, and then therefore you're reestablishing the original environment by adding the wolves back? Or is the natural environment what happened after they disappeared? Which is, you know, which one has more moral value is always a question here. Of course, Australia is completely different. Like, one thing I loved about going to the Australian National Museum in Canberra was the whole section of the museum dedicated to, you know, the rabbits and the effort to eradicate them, and the fence across the continent, and then the pathogens that they created to try to kill them off. It's it reminded me a little bit of that comment that Worf makes in the Deep Space Nine part of the episode when he talks about the great tribal wars that the Klingons fought.
Well, yeah, I think Odo said that. He was kind of ribbing Worf about singing songs about the great tribal battle. But that's how this episode ends, is they beam all the tribbles over to the Klingon ship. And then we never know what happens to them after that point. And so presumably, yeah, like the tribbles took over the Klingon homeworld maybe. And so maybe Worf is right. They did have to eradicate the scourge on their environment. It sounds like they did. And now all the tribbles are dead in the 24th century. But I don't know how well Australia did.
That's true. I think there's still there's some battles there. But if they're being reintroduced, you'll be pleased to hear, into the 24th century at the end of the Deep Space Nine episode.
That's true. Yet another battle to fight amongst the Klingon Empire.
Indeed. So I think in some of the gripey sections that we were talking about, we were, you know, we disliked, or perhaps just noticed, you know, when numbers are being pulled out of the air, the techno babble. And so one of the nice things with this episode is that I think Spock gives a little bit of clarity, talks about solar years ago specifically. And it's interesting how all of this, you know, fits into, you know, the whole Stardate thing, which originally started out as something that was meant to hide what year this was actually taking place. But that didn't last very long, I don't think.
Yeah, so in Star Trek, they very often start an episode by saying, Captain's Log, Stardate 42185. And it seems like a pretty meaningless number. And in reading up on it, it is somewhat meaningless. But because as John said, it was kind of meant to hide the fact that we didn't know exactly when in the future this was taking place. But it immediately reminded me of something we do use in astronomy today, which is the Julian date. So I just looked it up right before the podcast. Today, March 5th, 2025, is Julian date 2460740. And then after the dot, that would be the time of the day. So that's constantly changing. And so maybe they got some inspiration from that. Oftentimes you'll see astronomical events taking place in Julian dates. But the other reason I think that they wanted to introduce these star dates is the fact that everyone's moving at the speed of light or faster, and time is relativistic. So it's not the same if you're moving really fast than if you're not moving really fast. And so that could mean that it's a different date on a starship than it would be back on Earth. And so you need some way of keeping track of that. And so you could do that with a star date.
Challenging though, right? Correcting for all of these interesting things to figure out when you arrive in another location exactly, you know, what time it is. It's not a trivial calculation when you're spending a lot of time traveling near, at, beyond the speed of light.
Yeah, I don't know how they actually come up with these numbers, and they seem somewhat random if you actually look at the numbers. Like, I think Kirk says we're somewhere in stardate like 4000s. But then when we get to Deep Space Nine, now it's like a factor of 10 greater, and it's only been, I don't know, 100 years. So it seems a bit random, the actual numbers they use. But there's some basis in science there, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's nice to see that, I think, and that throwback to the Julian dates. You know, you're thinking about some of the things taking place, you know, as people changed over, more and more countries changed over at that time from imperial units to metric units. And what's more metric than the decimal day in some ways? So maybe this is imagining that discussion going out. So, I mean, around that time, I know Canada went metric. I think at one point the U.S. was thinking about it, but it didn't quite pan out. I didn't actually research this before I came on here, but I think there were discussions at the time as well.
Right. I think the U.S. is one of a handful of countries that has not gone to the metric system, though. So I'm not sure why they decided against it, but they are not the majority here. So maybe one day we'll be saying, hey, what were you doing in Stardate 2460740 instead of saying, hey, what were you doing last March? You know, so we'll see. We'll see. We're not there yet.
No. And the worst part of it is I think it fails the test of being accessible to human beings. So one thing that I enjoy when we go to other planets, we go to Mars, we name everything around. And originally the thought was, well, we should give these things numbers and alphanumeric designations, but no one can remember those things. And it's much easier to remember, you know, things like a name. And I think once your star dates get big enough, they become a little indecipherable. Like you mentioned the current Julian date. I'm going to have a hard time thinking about what that means and what the Julian date was, you know, a year ago. I can do math to figure that out, but I think it's not innate in quite the same way.
Yeah, and to their credit, when they're talking amongst themselves and not recording a formal log, they do say things like, oh, you know, tomorrow or last week. So they use those more colloquial terms when they're just talking amongst themselves.
That's true. You end up with two systems that are kind of operating side by side there. I guess it's no different than astronomers who use, you know, Julian date all the time, but who wouldn't really, you know, use that kind of terminology with their friends and families and things like that.
Right. Or Canadians, since we live so close to the U.S., often we talk about our weight in pounds, but our height in centimeters, you know, so it's this weird hybrid amongst two systems. And it's just what you get used to.
Indeed. So I think we should probably pick on something from the Deep Space Nine episode here. And this is the science shine part, so maybe not pick on. But the Trill symbiont thing, I think you found very interesting.
Yeah, so one of the characters, Jadzia Dax, in this episode, they don't talk about it much in this episode, although it does come up as a plot point, is that she's a symbiont between a Trill, so that's the exterior that we see, Jadzia, and then, what do they call the symbiont? I'm not sure it has a name, but it's like this little worm creature that lives inside her, which is Dax. And Dax has been around for hundreds of years. I looked it up. Dax, the symbiont, was born in 2018. So he's out there somewhere swimming around in his little symbiont pond, getting ready to meet Jadzia hundreds of years from now. But this is the process of symbiosis, right? Where two organisms coexist for mutual benefit. And more specifically, this would be considered endosymbiosis, where the one organism lives inside the other organism. And this does happen on Earth, but it's usually a single cellular organism living inside a multicellular organism, not two sentient multicellular organisms like we see here with Jadzia Dax. An example would be the microbes in our gut, right? Those are single cellular bacteria that help us with our digestive system, that live within us, and we help each other out.
One thing that I think is interesting here is that I do wonder to what extent it's not discussed. There's, I guess, a little bit of a taboo about it a little bit. But with the symbionts, there's this question of, you know, to what extent is it engineered, right? You know, is this a natural symbiosis that's been going on Trill forever? Or is this something that came on later on? There are episodes of Deep Space Nine where they talk about, you know, oh, a very small portion of the population is even suitable for this kind of symbiosis. Of course, the end of that episode is that many people are suitable for it, and the evil government has been restricting this for various other reasons. But they implant the symbionts surgically, and it makes you wonder, how would that happen by accident or without a sophisticated medical kind of tech to underlie this kind of thing? So it does make me wonder if this is something that is, you know, chosen, engineered, derived in some ways. It's interesting.
You can see the benefit of it, right? Like Jadzia has memories that are hundreds of years old. You know, she has this sort of nostalgic relationship with the original Enterprise. She even meets people that she had known in the past, you know? So you can see there's some benefit to that for having hundreds of years long memory for a species, for an individual. But yeah, how did it ever come to be? Like, why did somebody say, hey, let's stick this worm creature inside our abdomen and see what happens? So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how it originated. That does seem a little bit strange. But once they did it, they could probably see the benefits and engineer it from there.
Oh, absolutely. Like you say, it's a beneficial symbiosis. It's not a, you know, a parasitic kind of relationship. All right. Well, why don't we put a pin in the science shine? And then we'll go on to our third section where we talk about how this is really something of its time. So we'll be back in just a minute. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how The Trouble with Tribbles and even Trials and Tribulations are really of their own time a little bit. You know, what sort of situates them, even though they're, of course, set in the far future, what puts them in the late 1960s and the mid-1990s? And I feel like we wrote more for this section than any other. So tell you what, Catherine, take your pick. What would you like to start with?
Well, I really liked watching the old openings, both of the original series and of Deep Space Nine. You know, the classical music, and the actors' names come up, and you can see the Enterprise kind of zooming around. I miss those old style introductions. TV is like a little too polished, I think, these days, and I miss these openings. The one thing I do want to note too is that it was a big deal when Star Trek The Next Generation came out in the 80s that they changed the words from the opening for Star Trek The Original Series. So in that opening, Kirk says, you know, we're going to go where no man has gone before. And they made a conscious choice in the 80s to switch that to where no one has gone before. Again, thinking of this idea of inclusivity, you know, not making it feel like women should be excluded from this exploration. And so it was interesting to see that difference between the original series and later series of Star Trek.
Yeah, I feel like that's one way where, in fact, Star Trek was kind of not of its time, in that even the original series, you know, was something that was, you know, quite inclusive. And this was something that was talked about at the time, not just the inclusion of women on the crew, but also you have not only the aliens as well, but also actors who come from different ethnic groups who are valued members of the crew. And this is something that I always enjoyed about Star Trek, to contrast it a little bit with Star Wars. Like, Star Wars is diverse. There is definitely a lot of different kinds of aliens and different kinds of people there. But some of it is kind of treated the way if you're going to, a carnival or a freak show type of thing, in that, you know, you've got these, you know, look at this bizarre thing that's over there. And it's not really a person. By the way, you can go ahead and send me email, all you Star Wars fans out there who want to argue your point. On Star Trek, it's different. It seems like every alien that they come across is automatically, you know, this is another person. And everyone on the crew, you know, these divisions seem to have dissolved. So I always enjoyed, you know, these folks working together for common purpose. And it's that common purpose that's important rather than the differences between them.
Yeah, they really led the way, I think, in this idea of inclusion and inclusivity, in addition to diversity. They're real leaders here in television. Although one thing I did notice that was different between the original series and TNG and Deep Space Nine are the Klingons. So Klingons are another race of aliens, but in the original series, they just look like humans with beards. They don't have that classic bumpy forehead that we're used to from the 1980s. Onward. Although you said, I think they originally introduced that in one of the original series movies. Is that right?
I think the first time you run into the bumpy headed Klingons is Star Trek III, which is their first appearance in the movie series. And I wonder if they wanted to do something interesting and different. So when they reintroduced the Klingons, they had this different makeup. And then they do it again in Star Trek Discovery. And they just go completely wild. So you have all of these different Klingon clans with completely different, you know, bumpy foreheads.
Yeah, although I did play for comedy when they have Worf there sitting in the commissary and they're like, oh, those are Klingons. And they're like, those are Klingons because they don't look anything like Worf. So clearly they were punting that, but it played for comedy and I didn't mind it too much.
Oh, yeah. I think it's enjoyable when they poke fun at these sorts of things, because we've got to remember that this is a TV show. And as it reinvents itself, it likes to play with its format. That's one thing I've always enjoyed about Star Trek, is that, you know, they have this canon, as it were, but they're never shy about changing things and playing with things in interesting ways. I enjoyed there was a little play on the TV costuming, because, you know, those of us who've grown up on the original series, when we saw The Next Generation, it's like, why is the captain wearing red, right? And so there's this thing that Bashir and Sisko go through, where, you know, what Sisko does is he says, well, you know, in this time period, command officers wore gold and operations people wore red. And then Jadzia chimes in, and women wore less, which, you know, is meant to be a joke about the 22nd century, but it's really a joke about the 1960s.
Yeah, although I love in the first few episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, which, you know, was the late 80s, they had people wearing dresses still. So you could wear a dress uniform like Jadzia is in this episode, but some of them were men, right? You didn't have to be a woman wearing a dress. It was gender neutral. And so I thought that was really cool in TNG. Unfortunately, they dropped that very quickly. And by the end of it, everyone's just wearing these pajama-like pantsuits and the dresses are gone. But I thought it was cool that they could, you know, allow men to wear dresses and it wasn't a big deal. Again, thinking about that idea of diversity and inclusivity. But another thing about the fashion is that it kind of looks like they're all wearing pajamas in the future, right? And I kind of think that might be where fashion is trending. I take my son to school every day and pass by a high school, and I swear every kid there is going to school in their pajamas, which is not a thing that I did as a teenager in the 90s. So maybe we're all just getting into this casual yoga wear, and that's where the future of fashion is going, and that's represented in Star Trek. To be fair, it's super comfortable, right? I'd rather wear that than high heels and, you know, shoulder pads. So I think they're on the right track there.
The future does seem very comfortable, not just the, you know, the sleepwear, but also the padded floors. I remember reading a description of why Star Trek The Next Generation was so popular. And the idea was, you know, you're there and it's the evening, you're relaxing, and you turn on the TV and you see Captain Picard there in his loungewear, sitting in his easy chair with his great big, you know, TV screen. And so there's this instant relatability.
Yeah, the future is very carpeted, which is not something I'd really appreciated until I started to rewatch some of these Star Trek episodes, which seems terrible, right? It's got to get dirty all the time. And you never see anyone cleaning it. You know, in this episode, they have the characters, you know, fixing electronics or, you know, wall panels and whatnot. But you don't see the guy with the vacuum, right? Where's that guy? And why are the carpets not horribly stained? So I think that was one prediction that is very much of its time. Like, I do not think the future is carpeted. It's just a hassle to clean.
It would be a problem, but I think you're absolutely right about things. There may be a backlash at some point, but I find it interesting going to older and older movies and things like that. The level of formality just goes up and up and up.
Formality, how so?
Oh, just thinking about, you know, taking a look at what people are wearing, both men and women, as you go back in time. And, you know, it wasn't so long ago that, you know, everyone at work wore a suit, for instance. And you see people who are relaxing, you know, on the weekends in like a sweater vest and a tie, which you find less of these days, more formal like wool pants. And as you go back to like the 19th century and the 18th century, the kinds of dress and fashion that existed, you know, were even more elaborate and ornate than that. So we're definitely proceeding towards sleepwear. I do remember another original series episode where someone, I think Kirk was trying to convince someone that he came from the future, and he's like, "Feel the fabric of my shirt," and it just makes me think of this. You know, yes, that's very comfy.
Speaking of Kirk's shirt, you'll notice in rewatching this episode that his shirt looks green, and all the other folks look gold. And so I looked this up, and it actually turns out that they were all meant to be the same color, but they were slightly different fabric. And so they show up as different colors under the bright lights on film. And so even though Kirk is supposed to be the same kind of gold color as everyone else, because of this difference in the fabrics, his ends up looking more green. So anyways, just fun historical fact there.
He is in the gold in most of the episodes, but he also has like the one that he wears in this one, which seems to be some strange alternate because they also move the insignia down on the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a wraparound. I heard it was because he was gaining a little bit of weight, and so they wanted to give him a little bit of room to grow in this uniform.
Well, we've definitely had some interesting one-offs. You mentioned Troy, for instance, you know, speaking of the line of sleepwear-inspired uniforms, who often had something that seemed a little bit non-standard.
That's right. Yeah. So Deanna Troi is a character from Star Trek The Next Generation. And even though she's, I think, a lieutenant commander in Starfleet, she never wears a uniform. I don't know why, but it is funny because there's one episode in the fifth or sixth season where they switch captains for a time, and he's really on her case about the uniform. And so she actually switched into a proper uniform. And from there on out, she wears the uniform. And honestly, it looks better on her. I don't know why they put her in this kind of saggy jumpsuit for the rest of the series. I guess they wanted to show some cleavage or something, but honestly, you know, I think everyone in the uniform together looks much more crisp.
Oh, agreed. I think that was nice with Deep Space Nine. You didn't sort of see that. You had, and of course, they too had to invent a different uniform and a different insignia a few years in as well, just to, you know, spice things up a little bit. And, you know, one thing that I think, you know, we both picked up on watching this episode was that nostalgic fun, even in the 90s. So you've got, you know, how Deep Space Nine and the original series are of their time, but just you've got Dax especially, who is just so totally fangirling for the, you know, for the original series. And they actually explain it. They say, well, she lived in this time, so she has real nostalgia for this time. But she really gives the audience, I think, a conduit in this, what's really an anniversary episode, you know, remembering, you know, at that point, 30 years of Trek.
Yeah, I think she was a stand-in for all the fans at that point. So one thing we haven't mentioned is the reason they did this episode is because it was celebrating the 30th anniversary of Star Trek, the original series. So that came out in 1966, and this was now 1996. What's interesting is we're now coming up on 2026, right? So I'm wondering if they're going to do another Tribbles episode. Maybe Strange New Worlds could reintroduce it. Tell us what happened to all those Tribbles that ended up on Deep Space Nine. Although I guess Strange New Worlds is set in the past. So anyways, I think it'd be fun if they kept doing this every 30 years as a sort of homage to the original series.
Yeah, unfortunately, their crossover with the original series was just a little bit too early. They did an alternate version of Balance of Terror, which is an original series episode with the Romulans. So I am going to be curious because, of course, we've got Strange New Worlds coming out this summer as well. So will they have one in there that
tries to
pull span? Absolutely.
Fingers crossed. Absolutely. I could use some more fuzzy globes. Speaking of toy-like props, it was really interesting looking at the original series because obviously it was produced in the 60s and the production values were very different. And now with the remastered video, you can really see kind of all the problems with the interior set design. You know, it looks like a child's spaceship kind of being suspended by a wire floating around in space. You know, some of the sets clearly look like they're made out of wood and cardboard. So it definitely doesn't look very futuristic nowadays. It's more that nostalgia that Janzia was talking about, you know, that classic design from the 60s. But certainly it doesn't look of the future anymore.
Yeah, I enjoy that Lower Decks loves to poke fun at all of this stuff. They have an episode called Caves about all the episodes that take place in caves. And the original series used to do this to save money. You know, you have a set that you can entirely control that you can whip up in an afternoon and it doesn't need to be precise. And I remember those caves episodes. Sometimes, you know, people would get into fights and someone would get thrown against the wall of the cave, which would then like vibrate because, you know, it was just this cheaply made set. But you've got that, I think, willing suspension of disbelief a little bit there. You know, it's fun. And one of the other things that often gets discussed when you're talking about the original series, and I think there was a documentary on this called, you know, how Star Trek, you know, invented the modern world. Things like the flip communicators that look a little bit like flip phones. And, you know, some of the computer technology, like the data pads, you know, and stuff like this. One thing I think that Star Trek often gets knocked on about is about how, when it comes to the computer side of things, they didn't do a good job predicting the future. The computers got better much quicker than anybody, I think, in the 60s could have imagined. And you have these interesting concepts then that served as a little bit as motivation, I think, for some people who are working in engineering and in science to try to, you know, make these things real. So that's always a neat aspect of the show, I think.
Yeah, although we've got a ways to go, right? We're not talking to our computers yet and having them solve all our problems for us. Although in rewatching some of these episodes and basically having the characters like ask the computer to do their work for them, it does remind me of, you know, modern like AI and these large language models where our university students are asking the computer to do the work for them, right? Please calculate this, you know, complicated scenario, computer, and then they think for 2 seconds and they spit out the answer. So I don't think we're quite there yet. There's more work to be done there, although I can see hints of it coming down the line.
It's true. But luckily, the Enterprise computer never hallucinates.
I'm sorry. We're not talking about TNG, but I've just been watching TNG lately. And it's amazing how many episodes the entire crew would have died if they didn't happen to have an android on board who wasn't like subject to viruses or lack of oxygen or temperature. Data saves their butts time and time again because he's not biological. So maybe that's what we need to do. We need our android friend to save us when everything goes awry.
Yeah, you'd think that all of the crew members, and definitely the bridge crew, would have some severe post-traumatic stress disorder just from all of the stuff that happens to them, you know, over the course of this. There's a great book I have to recommend if you've noticed this too, Red Shirts by, I know, a favorite author of yours as well, Catherine John Scalzi. So that one just makes a whole plot out of this idea that the bridge crew never seems to come to any trouble and seems to be able to get out of every scrape just in the nick of time and using only the resources they have available. Like you say, Commander Data suddenly lets them get into and out of other scrapes.
They're the luckiest bridge crew in the world.
Indeed.
Apart from all the other Star Trek series.
All right. So perhaps at this point, what we'll do is we'll go on to the ratings and chat about, you know, how we sort of see this, you know, in a broad scope. So we'll be back with that in just a second.
All right, welcome back, everyone. So this is the part of the episode where we rank the episode on a scale of 5 in 3 categories for its science accuracy, its influence, and how it holds up as a television show over time. So we'll start with science accuracy. John, how accurate do you think the science was in these 2 episodes?
So I'm going to call this one a 2. I don't think that the science is particularly accurate. I think your categorization at the start of the episode that this is kind of like science fantasy in a sense, you know, tends to be true. They make motions towards science and they do try to, you know, get in the right direction. But in terms of accuracy, I don't think that that's, you know, first and foremost in the heads of the writers.
Yeah, I gave it a 3 because there were a lot of these magical plot devices that kind of take you out of the show. But I bumped it up a little bit from you because there were a few things that really impressed me. The fact that they got the math right on the number of tribbles, I was surprised to see that. The fact that triticale is an actual grain and they did their research there was interesting. And even like little things like Spock saying it was solar years ago, right? You know, being very specific about that. I like that. So somewhere in the middle, I would put it.
That's fair. That's fair. And I think where this really shines is the influence.
I agree. Yes. So our next category is how much has not necessarily these 2 episodes of Star Trek, but Star Trek in general influenced society and us specifically. So what did you rank this for influence, John?
So this one I have to give the full 5-star rating to here. Star Trek is, you know, known throughout the world. It's been a franchise that has just kept on going. It started with a 3-year run in the 60s, but then it was brought back in the 70s as an animated series, then as a whole series of movies, including a reboot, including movies just for the Next Generation too, and then many more series. It's something that really has influenced people. And I think part of that is the optimism, but part of it is also just the way that things are described. And I think those documentaries that I mentioned in the last segment about, you know, how Star Trek created the modern world, there's some truth to that it showed a picture of how the world could be, and people wanted to bring elements of that into existence, you know, not just the tech, but also the way that people work together and even the mission of the Enterprise.
So you gave it a 5.
I did.
I also gave this a 5. You'd be hard-pressed to find a person on Earth who's never heard of Star Trek. As John said, it's been an ongoing societal phenomenon for the past, my gosh, are we up to 60 years now?
We're close.
I mean, people could, you know, recognize the Star Trek uniform on site. People do the Vulcan symbol. I can't, actually. My fingers don't work that way. But people know what that means. So it's just really invaded our cultural zeitgeist in a way that very few series have. So it's definitely, for me, is a 5. But, you know, these episodes are very old. This is the oldest episode we've covered so far. 1967 it came out. That was before we went to the moon. I mean, that's how old this episode is. So how does it hold up, do you think, John?
How does it hold up? My goodness. So I think that the way that we think about the future has changed quite a bit. There are things that we have in our modern world that the folks on Star Trek could only dream of. They wish they would have some of this technology as well. So in terms of, you know, how does it hold up? I think I'm going to stick with a 2 on this one as well.
Yeah, I was a little bit more generous. I gave it a 3, but clearly, like, Star Trek, the original series, is of its time. It's clearly a very old episode with different production values than we would see today. Deep Space Nine holds up a little bit better, but you can still tell it's a bit dated. So still fun to watch. Honestly, I had a great time watching these episodes. They were funny and fun to watch. So even with the, you know, less than perfect set design and whatnot, I still really enjoyed these episodes.
Oh, yeah. I think that playfulness I always appreciate as an element within science fiction. The idea that ultimately, when you're talking about speculative fiction, you're talking about play, right? You're talking about enjoying playing with a concept and bringing that into the episode in general. You just can't beat it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I love about Star Trek the most, is they don't take themselves too seriously. A lot of TV shows these days are so serious, and I just want to have some fun when I relax at the end of the day and go off into a fictional universe where I can enjoy it.
So listeners, join us for some more fun next time around when we take a look at another movie or television show. And until next time, live long and prosper. Science is hosted by Catherine Nish and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.